Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call. I'm in today for Rose Aguilar, and today we're going to ask you to picture your closest, most popular bus stop or train station. Now, imagine what that area would look like if four- or five-story buildings filled with apartments or condominiums were built nearby. That's the future that's envisioned by a Senate bill, SB 827. It's a proposal that's now working its way through the legislature, and it would supersede all local controls and allow the construction of taller, denser housing near public transportation hubs. The idea is to, of course, create more housing to be built near transit, thereby creating more housing stock, but also encouraging any new residents to live car-free. SB 827 has been a real touchstone for people on various sides of this issue. Homeowners and existing tenants in up-and-coming neighborhoods are pushing back hard on this. For one thing, they say that their voice will be erased, that local control over housing decisions would be taken away from their community and be given to the state. The state would have the ability to make those laws and rules. And they say that real estate in already hot up-and-coming neighborhoods, that real estate would become even more valuable and lead to even more displacement. So, what to expect from SB 827? How would California change after such a sweeping change to building guidelines? It's a major change. And to discuss it with us in the studio today is Michelle Majeed. She's Program Director of Equitable Development at Urban Habitat. It's a nonprofit that works to address structural inequities in regional land use and transportation planning. Thanks for coming in, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Also joining us is Louis Morante, Legislative and Partnerships Director for the statewide group called Yes in My Backyard. And he's speaking with us from Sacramento, California. YIMBY is a pro-housing development group, and it's actually sponsoring SB 827. So, Louis, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's start by talking about why supporters anticipate this bill and opponents fear it. And for those of us who aren't transit wonks, I know the two of you, these are issues that really dovetail in some very important ways in California. Whenever you talk housing and transportation in California, you get people's attention. But SB 827 may not be familiar. So just to let folks know, SB 827 is proposed by State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco, and it would override any local control on building heights. The state would say that in areas that are very close to transit, housing of a certain height must be permitted. The idea is to make it easier for developers to build housing and build it near transit so that people who move in are not reliant on cars. Louis, let's talk about the components of the bill and some of the amendments that Senator Wiener offered as recently as yesterday.
Great, yeah. So I think you described the bill aptly. The bill would allow buildings up to 45 or 55 feet from major transit stops in California, depending on some different variables. The bills yesterday, or the amendments yesterday, rather, increased some of the anti-displacement measures in the bill, all of which we strongly support. They put in a provision requiring that some of the units created through SB 827 be intentionally for low-income and very low-income Californians. Like you mentioned, this bill is a great way to get at sort of the new type of environmentalism that is less car-centric and more transit-friendly. This is a sort of transit-oriented development bill for sure. We're strongly supporting the bill because it helps solve the state's critical housing shortage. California, as most listeners will know, has a real homelessness crisis, has a real crisis with rising rents. And SBA 27 is going to help tackle the state's really, really dramatic housing problems.
One of the things that it does is to lower the upper height limit. So it was 8 to 10 stories. So when you talk about 85 feet, we're actually talking stories here. So let's talk about the fact that those amendments were maybe made to maybe ease some of the concerns that people had, Michelle, about the density that people are concerned about. So the amendments would lower the upper height limit of the buildings. It would offer more protections for tenants. It would actually change the definition of what a transit hub is, right? And would that actually assuage some of your concerns?
Yeah, it's good to see that the bill is heading in the in a better direction, but our main concern is that SB 827 targets gentrifying, low-income, class-diverse, highly transit-dependent communities of color while not doing much to challenge and reverse the trend of exclusivity in wealthier suburbs, since many of these places don't have access to public transportation and therefore the bill wouldn't apply to them. And I think the solution to correct for historically segregationist policies is not to help fuel modern-day resegregation through upzoning and inflating land values and speculation and displacing lower-income renters of colors from the communities they helped build.
So let me make sure that I have the picture here. What you're saying is that urban communities that already have lots of transit hubs and density are the ones that are going to be impacted by this, not communities in the suburbs, which tend to be whiter and wealthier. They would almost be unscathed by this. Is that your point?
Right. We saw in different analyses that cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles and Oakland, more than 90% of the neighborhoods in those cities would be affected by this legislation. And not many, again, suburbs would be impacted by SB 827 since, again, they're not near transit hubs.
Well, right now they have no requirements at all. This would put some requirements on them. Lewis, how do you respond to the fact that this would have a disproportionate impact?
Well, first off, I just want to acknowledge that that criticism and concern is very valid. And California YIMBY is a new organization, has a lot to learn, I think, from people who've been leading on this issue before us. And we're excited to take the energy that we've been building around this bill and, you know, sort of apply it elsewhere in the future on an ongoing basis towards solving and identifying more of these problems. I would say that about some of these concerns, I've had the chance to dive into a lot of them. I think there's more conversation that's needed, and my organization and I personally could be doing a better job to engage more dialogue on exactly these concerns. I would push back just a little bit on some of these points, though. I would argue that the bill's effect on suburbs is maybe not as narrow as some have said. I haven't had time to dive too deep into the analysis of the most recent amendments, but the bill has not substantially scaled back the bus service, and so I'm comfortable saying what I'm about to say. The previous version of the bill upzoned almost the entirety of the Beverly Hills. It upzoned.
What do you mean by upzoned? Can you just?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and sorry, that's a wonky word that's kind of scary to some people. The bill would allow for increased density on residential land. So in much of Beverly Hills, you can only build a single-family home. Only one family can live on the parcel. And that's helped contribute to Beverly Hills being a very expensive place. Our bill would say, under the current amendments, that developer, home builders, whomever, could choose to build a higher density building that would be more affordable than the surrounding single-family homes, and that a portion of those homes would have to be reserved for low-income or very low-income tenants based on several guidelines in the bill. in the Bay Area, more locally, the bill would add housing density to Piedmont, California, to some of the more exclusive neighborhoods within San Francisco, to Cupertino, to the wealthier parts of Menlo Park, and to several places in Marin, including Benicia and Petaluma and Belvedere.
Well, one of the things that keeps California property values, Michelle, up is the fact that there's not much of it. There's not much building. So slow upward or outward expansion is what keeps property values up. So when you have people who are fighting this sort of denser development, doesn't it become sort of a class issue?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what we're not saying is to stop development. I think what we're saying is we're against displacement. And, you know, we have a three P's approach. We start with tenant protections, and then we move on to affordable housing preservation and production. And I think, you know, we agree that we need to build deeply affordable housing near transit, and also put policies into effect that protect people in place who already live in these transit-rich, diverse, inclusive working-class neighborhoods. And, you know, the logic that we can just build our way out of the crisis just does not hold. You know, trickle-down economics and deregulation has never helped people of color. We know that to be true. It's displaced us. It's caused hyper-policing, racist hyper-policing in our neighborhoods. And it's really separated families. I've experienced it personally growing up in the San Fernando Valley in L.A. And, you know, I go back to my city and it's really hard to recognize because of the ways in which it was flipped for speculation in the 90s and the early 2000s.
Well, another aspect of the bill is a movement toward transit use and away from car use. Lewis, how much do you really expect a proposal like this to increase transit ridership? And can the current transit systems even handle a major increase?
Yeah, absolutely. So before I stepped into this role, I was just an analyst with the state with the State Department of Finance, and I, as a young professional, have just sort of chosen to never own a car. I think that I am in like increasingly large part of the demographic of people who are opting out of cars for expense reasons and convenience reasons. And we know from the research that when development is sited near transit, people just opt in to using transit at a much higher rate because it's more convenient. I'd also mention that the bill would provide for free transit passes for the tenants of SB 827 homes now, so that we'd further be incentivizing folks to actually contribute to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and reducing our traffic. And to your question about whether the transit can handle it, we've unfortunately, especially in LA, seen a large slump in transit ridership as the economy has improved. Traffic has gotten worse, and transit ridership has fallen. So I think this is actually a real shot in the arm for California's transit providers, and organizations like BART have expressed their support for the proposal for that reason.
And maybe the ridership is just down because the transit is bad, especially in LA. So would this not serve to address that problem? It would almost create a need-based transit planning.
Yeah, and I'm glad you pointed this out earlier, Renee. I think it's important to focus on the race and class implications of this bill. Mm-hmm. We know that the most transit-dependent populations are lower-income people of color, right? They often don't have the choice to buy a car. And when they are displaced, either directly or indirectly through densification and upzoning, then they have to unfortunately switch to polluting cars, older models. And they are pushed further and further out of their cities, out of their localities, but there's still that push and pull factor because their jobs are located in the inner core. So because they have to switch to polluting cars, it increases greenhouse gas emissions, for example, which is antithetical to what this bill is hoping to achieve. And so I just wanted to point out that, you know, the burden, again, disproportionately falls on low-income people of color who are, you know, they're increasingly renters. They're not they're more vulnerable. They are transit dependent. And so the more we can protect them in place to remain in their communities, then, you know, we don't exacerbate the growing problem of exclusion and displacement and gentrification.
And Lewis, you certainly can't escape the racial and class and gentrification issues that come into this discussion of transportation and housing. How critical is that consideration?
Absolutely. I would say it is of the utmost criticality that we find the right path forward here. Just sort of more generally, my organization, California YIMBY, really, really tries quite hard to be an inclusive organization rather than an exclusive organization. And, you know, maybe offline we can connect about how some ideas to solve this problem and get your input on some of these challenges, because I agree this is sort of at the forefront, I think, of every form of politics in California.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like you both agree that what you're concerned about most is unintended consequences if this goes forward. Mm-hmm. So, Masha, what is your concern about unintended consequences?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important for me as a practitioner to historicize legislation and just, you know, when in understanding the context of today around exclusivity and growing gentrification, it's important to make the connection that, you know, even in the 30s through the 50s, through policies like urban renewal, there were 66% of those affected areas were black and brown neighborhoods. And, you know, you saw the green light for slum clearance. And so I think it's, you know, increasingly I reminisce, I think about those things when looking at all sweeping one size fits all legislation like this, which, again, would disproportionately impact communities of color. You know, upwards of 90%, again, of cities like LA and Oakland would be affected by this. So I think it's important to take that historical piece into consideration.
And Lewis Mirante, I know you probably know of the law of unintended consequences. If this were to play out in the worst case scenario for you, what would it look like?
Well, I'd rather more sort of emphasize that the status quo is probably. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree that the status quo, left unchanged, mm-hmm. is leading, has been leading, and will lead to bad consequences. I mean, the status quo in California is that rent's going up in Los Angeles, and we know from the data that a 4.5 to 5% increase in market rate rents in Los Angeles will create 2,000 homeless people. It'll push them out of their homes, and that's absolutely unacceptable. I don't think anyone in California accepts that. That's just terrible. We're trying to work on solutions to rising rents, to fight rising rents, for all of these reasons.
If you're just joining us, Michelle Majid, Program Director of Equitable Development at Urban Habitat, is with us today, along with Lewis Mirante. He's Legislative and Partnerships Director for California YIMBY, a statewide pro-housing development group. And today, we're talking about SB 827, the idea of building multifamily units, denser housing around transportation. What do you think of the idea of building more housing around transit hubs? If you live near one, how might it impact your community? Is this a good idea or a bad one? 866-798-8255 is the number. Some groups have raised concerns, Lewis, that displacement of existing tenants near transit actually pushes those tenants out to areas without transit. And that's one of the concerns that Michelle has expressed. And we have really kind of seen a preview of what that looks like with urban renewal, I mean, under different circumstances and with different impetus. It seems to have already happened. We've seen what that can look like, yes?
Oh, absolutely. I think actually one of the thing that motivates my work is how bad things were during the era of highway buildings. I mean, Robert Moses, who is the transportation commissioner for New York and started the interstate highway system, he personally evicted upwards of 500,000 people in his life. And that's horrifying. Mm. I am extremely concerned about displacement as well. The bill has some current protections in there, but they can always be improved. So, you know, just sort of along my refrain of California YIMBY being an open audience to ideas about how to fix this problem, you know, your listeners and anyone else, we welcome feedback. Happy to talk to people. The bill's anti-displacement protections are some of the strongest anti-displacement protections in currently proposed that I'm aware of in California. The bill would say that to be eligible for the bonus, a home builder will have to find a new unit, a commensurable unit for any affected tenant, relocate them, so pay for all the moving costs, pay for the increase in rent for 3.5 years. So it's essentially rent control funded by developer profit. And then after that 3.5 year period, after the building is built, the old tenant would have to be offered a unit in the new building at the rate that the tenant was offered it. The bill also establishes the affordable housing requirement so that, you know, we're intentionally building housing for low and very low income Californians. And I would just want to emphasize that the status quo remains eviction. It remains rising rents, and we have to address that. Now, we have to address it in a way that has no unintended consequences or as few as possible. And I think the bill currently strikes a fine balance, but that we can always work harder to improve those elements. And so I'm open to new ideas.
I think it's interesting, Lewis, just to follow up on that, that this seems to put all the requirements on cities and very few on developers.
We wanted to actually not engage cities' local control beyond what we really needed to do to solve the problem that we're trying to solve. So developers are subject to local control on things like inclusionary zoning, things on building code standards, things on sort of whether or not you build green, whether or not you are offering electric chargers, that sort of thing. We wanted to leave that control in local hands because we agree that local control on that side is has been helpful and is that's, you know, local communities should decide that. The bill just permits the construction of high density or higher density housing. Again, 4 stories, 5 stories max. And that's the type of density that a lot of people find very appealing about sort of the old downtowns that we have in California or even places like maybe not in downtown, but, you know, around the lake in Lake Merritt. The bill doesn't we intentionally do this preempt any local control on things like affordable housing requirements or rent protection. The bill does not allow for the demolition of rent controlled units, and the bill does not allow for the construction of units on a site that has been the Ellis Act is a way to evict tenants without just cause. So the bill would not apply to sites that were affected by the Ellis Act if a developer used the Ellis Act. So there are definitely some anti-displacement constraints on developers, but we wanted to make sure that local communities retained as much control as they currently have around several of these questions.
If you're just joining us, we're talking SB 827. It is a sweeping proposal, and it's designed to get more housing built near public transportation. Supporters say it's a great idea. More housing, fewer carbon emissions. Opponents say it's a giveaway to developers, and it will accelerate gentrification. What do you think about SB 827? Our lines are full. We invite you to join them. We'll take your calls right after this. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp. In for Rose Aguilar, this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. If you have a show idea, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Coming up tomorrow, we're talking 50 years since the Fair Housing Act. So why is there still racial disparity in home ownership? That's tomorrow on Your Call. Today, we're talking about what to expect from SB 827. It's a statewide proposal to allow denser housing near public transportation. Lots of passion on both sides of that issue. And let's start by going to the calls who have been waiting for a while. People feel very strongly about the whole idea of housing and transportation. And in SB 827, those two things dovetail. So let's go to Matthew first. Hi, Matthew. Thanks for holding.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What's your concern?
Well, I have a question, I think mostly for Michelle. Michelle, thanks a lot for your comments. I really appreciate what you've been saying about the need for protections for renters and to prevent displacement. And I personally am a gentrifier. I'm a nonprofit executive, and my partner was working on her PhD. We were looking for an affordable apartment in San Francisco, and we couldn't find one. So we ended up purchasing a home in Berkeley. This was about 5 or 6 years ago. From an elderly African-American woman who was moving to Pasadena. But we did push out the renters who were here. That wasn't what we were hoping to achieve when we were looking for housing, but we didn't really have a choice. So I guess my question is, what are the sorts of things that you would like to see the state legislature doing that sort of provide for people like me who would prefer to stay in these denser urban environments next to transit but couldn't afford to because I don't work in tech, I don't have a very high income, but also don't put us in the position of, you know, moving into these next rings out and pushing out the people who are living there currently.
Michelle Majid of Urban Habitat, your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. I appreciate your question. So I think, you know, right now we're fully supporting the repeal of Costa-Hawkins and also the Make It Fair campaign around Prop 13. So we'd love for those to be passed, hopefully through a voter initiative. And I think, you know, the way to actually think about our barometer of success in alleviating the current housing affordability crisis is to really count the number of people housed and not just the number of units built. So we need to adopt policies like rent control and just cost for eviction, so people aren't, you know, evicted for no fault, to make way for luxury development, for example. We also would want to see the adoption of anti-harassment and anti-discrimination policies to keep current residents in place, and really having increasing, you know, flexible rapid funds for affordable housing preservation and production, and thinking about alternative development models like community land trusts, and thinking about things like municipal land banking for affordable housing, you know. And along with that, right, all of us lead multi-issue lives. We can't just see housing in isolation. We also need to increase the minimum wage to actual living wage standards, right? We need to end the speculation on unoccupied units and also just engage in our communities to come to some consensus together through organizing together, through having these conversations, which need to be more nuanced, to help people remain in their communities.
And Lewis, just to be clear, even though a lot of people are talking about this bill, it is not going to a vote by the public. It's making its way through the state legislature, and it needs to be heard by two more committees. But this is not going to a public vote. Today's amendment does delay the implementation to give communities more time to come up with their own requirements. But to what extent is that a concern for you or not?
You know, I have not given too much thought to that question. I think we've wanted to make sure that California is a place where everyone can afford. That's, you know, that's our mission. That's what we're here to do. The problem has been, and there are many problems related to housing. I shouldn't imply that there are just one. But the problem has been with local control, especially hyper-local voting control in California. The problem has been that we've had the power to at least fix the market rate side of our problem for 50 years. Local governments have had the problem to permit enough housing for market rate housing that this doesn't become a middle and upper middle income issue. Now, market rate policy is never going to fix the problem for low-income and very low-income tenants, which is why we wanted to include some of those protections in the bill so that we're being intentional about trying to address sort of the whole scope of the problem.
Do you think that go ahead.
Oh, yeah. But the problem of direct democracy on a project-by-project basis is one where newcomers, low-income people, minorities, millennials to neighborhoods are often excluded. And so while we have to be very mindful of protecting low-income tenants where they are and keeping them in those communities and not displacing them, you know, not allowing them to be evicted without just cause, those are very important things that you know we're working on as well. Yes.
Is this better? Are we better off with this in the hands of the legislature than voters?
I don't think so. I think the legislature is the right place to solve this problem. Direct democracy, especially hyper-local democracy on projects, you know, like I mentioned, has exacerbated and contributed to the problem of rising rents and rising homelessness in California. Direct democracy for public housing in California is particularly bad. So Article 34 of the state's constitution requires public housing projects subject to a vote by the people who live in the city. And I think folks on, you know, who are listening can kind of play that out in their heads. That's been a real challenge for constructing affordable housing for public housing policy and for housing policy in general, because a small minority of usually wealthy elites in a community can raise enough hell that those projects don't get built, and that just continues to exacerbate this problem. We all agree that this problem needs to be fixed, and so I think the legislature is institutionally the right place to fix it.
Michelle Majeed, you look very anxious to weigh in on that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak to a different part of that, which is the most impacted communities have the best solutions, right? And we need to take direction from those who are often on the fault lines and the front lines of, racist extractive systems. And we've seen communities organize around building more affordable housing in their neighborhoods, around passing policies. For the first time in 30 years, cities are passing rent control laws. And they're also very strategically and effectively using incentives like density to force developers to provide community benefits like more affordable housing at deeper levels. And so I also want to add more nuance to that often it is the same folks impacted by this crisis who are rising up and coming up with the solutions.
Okay, let's go to our callers again. Susan from San Francisco, thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. This bill is absolutely a wolf in sheep's clothing. It is a giveaway to developers. The YIMBYs are an AstroTurf pro-market rate housing organization that tries to pretend that they are really about addressing the housing crisis. The housing needs are different in different parts of this state. Merced, Fresno have very different housing issues than San Francisco. That's why the San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed a resolution opposing this bill. That's why the LA City Council passed a resolution opposing this bill. Housing activists have been able to extract agreements from developers in San Francisco to do more than the minimum inclusionary affordable housing, and they can continue to do that. But if this bill passes, their ability to do that will be eliminated. To say that they have preserved local control in this bill is a complete misrepresentation of what the bill does. It takes away local control, and it's really bad for housing. Also, when you build market rate housing near transit, it accomplishes the opposite, because higher income households are much less likely to be using public transit than low income housing. Transit corridors need to be preserved for affordable housing for low and moderate income housing, not have their local efforts be overruled by a state law that is a mandate to the city to give away this land at higher density levels to developers. I just have a comment. I didn't know I have a question.
Okay, thank you, Susan. Actually, clearly, this is something that people feel strongly about. Louis Moranti, the characterization of YIMBY is something I'm sure you'd like to address, as well as Susan's entire comment. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I feel like I don't need to address the characterization of YIMBY. It's kind of a personal attack, and, you know, I'm fine with that.
What about the bill being a wolf in sheep's clothing and a giveaway to developers?
Yeah. So I think, and on the city opposition, that's a good point, too. Mm-hmm. I would point out that the cities that oppose the bill are the cities with the biggest housing crisis. And if they lose their local control on this question, they're going to be forced to solve it. So I would say for renters, the people who rent in these cities, if not the actual Board of Supervisors, we're seeing a lot of support from the bill, actually. In places like San Mateo and Cupertino, we're seeing support for the bill. I was just down there last week. In the places where housing is most expensive in the state, we're seeing a lot of support from the people who are paying for housing. The idea that it's a giveaway to developers is not true. The bill requires developers to pay for low-income and very low-income housing in some of our most exclusionary cities. It doesn't pull back any ability of a local community to demand more from developers. So if cities set their own inclusionary zoning policies or exact their own inclusionary zoning requirements at the local level, those would trump what's in the bill. I would also mention that we've gotten a lot of support from this bill for traditional civil rights and fair housing advocates. So I'm sure folks on the radio will know who Richard Rothstein is, for example, who's the author of The Color of Law, which biographies the explicitly racist housing policy in the United States from the 1930s up until now. So we've gotten support from him for the bill and from other leading professors on civil rights issue, like Professor John A. Powell at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, and I would just last point there. These people correctly identify that the problem, especially in the Bay Area, is that folks like the people who live in the city that I grew up in, Piedmont, California, those people have locked out low-income people and people of color from their communities. I mean, the contrast between how white Piedmont is and how not white Oakland is and has been is largely a function of Piedmont's land use policy, which this bill would challenge. So the average home in Piedmont right now is $2.5 million, average home.
Right.
And this bill would authorize the construction of units that are substantially less than that. So I would definitely push back on this being a giveaway to developers and just the recipe for a luxury housing disaster. This housing is going to be much cheaper than what exists.
Okay. Let's go to another caller. I know you want to weigh in on this, Michelle, but quickly so we can get to all the callers. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think there's support for this bill from some of the cities that Lewis named because, it wouldn't directly affect them, right? It doesn't target suburbs of Silicon Valley, for example, where there's a severe imbalance of jobs to housing ratio. And it actually does, our fear is that it's auctioning off neighborhoods and incentivizing the demolition of rent control and affordable units to make way for more lucrative luxury market rate development. And, just having small concessions around one-to-one replacement for some affordable housing will not do the trick. That's not going to solve the crisis.
All right. Let's go to our next caller. Hi. Thanks for holding, Leslie from San Francisco. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I just wanted to add that tenant rights groups across the state are opposed to this, and the experts that were listed are not people that work directly with low-income tenants that are fighting evictions every day. And the main cause of evictions actually are Costa-Hawkins evictions, where people are harassed out, and those are not recorded. So the folks speaking to that they're going to protect renters and speaking on demolitions, well, that's a low number of the people that are actually going to be displaced by these projects. UC Berkeley, Urban Displacement Project, put out a transportation study showing that low-income folks near transportation hubs get displaced. And so you layer on market rate projects on top of people that are already facing displacements if they're near transit, and then what do you have? You have a giant, what we're calling a gentrification bomb. And so there's nothing in there. The way to solve the housing crisis isn't to force market rate housing. It's to put in protections for low-income renters to make sure that these projects don't displace them first. Nobody's prioritizing keeping current residents in their housing. So our question to all of these backers of this bill is, why don't you care about the tenants that are there that are facing displacement already? Like you're saying that in generations maybe it'll trickle down, but that's not good enough. They need to keep communities in their homes right now. So that's my thought. It's just, this is a giant. It is a giveaway to developers, because who's going to be able to afford to be a landlord on projects like this? It's going to be Wall Street landlords and giant landlords, which we know don't care about tenants. I was displaced twice in 2 years, and the last one was by a hedge fund. So I'm not seeing anything in this bill that actually addresses the problem for the people who need housing the most.
Great. Thank you so much for your input. Lewis, I'm going to let you respond to that. This really is huge, maybe a once-in-a-generation attempt at dealing with the dual issues of transportation and housing. So how do you respond to that?
Absolutely.
To those insights,
If I have not communicated concern for renters, then that's 100% on me, because I do this work. I took a pay cut to do this work because I care about renters, and because renters are as a renter myself, renter and pro-renter policy is at the forefront of what I politically care about. I would say that we do very much want to ensure that we're not displacing low-income tenants, and there are several provisions of the bill that we've discussed already that do that. The ban, for example, on demolishing rent-controlled homes, the ban on applying the bill to a place that has been subject to a not just cause eviction, an Ellis Act eviction, the requirement that developers essentially pay for rent control for affected tenants and then offer them a rent-controlled unit in the new building. There are substantial anti-displacement measures currently in the bill, but we are absolutely committed to working with any tenants' rights organization that wants to weigh in on the bill to improve those, because, we know that we can improve on that stuff. So I definitely care, and we definitely want to get it right. But the status quo is eviction in the Bay Area. I mean, San Francisco produced 10.3 jobs for every unit of housing that it produced since 2010. 10.3 jobs. I mean, that is a disaster for low-income people who live in San Francisco, because we're bringing in much, much higher wages to the Bay, and we're not providing substantial housing. So just just for folks who, you know, think that these units are going to, that new units are going to just these people who are flocking in from elsewhere, 97% of people who come to San Francisco for a job move into existing housing, 97%. That's driving a horrific tidal wave of displacement around the Bay Area and around the state. And it's a problem that we need to stop. We need to stop it with several different policy tools. And I'm not suggesting that SB 827 is the only policy tool that matters here. But building housing is critical if we're going to stop displacement.
Michelle Majeed?
Yeah, I would agree to some extent with the last point. Building deeply affordable housing will help alleviate the crisis, right? The densification of neighborhoods without strong tenant protections and inclusive decision making will only lead to more speculation and inequity, and upzoning in it of itself and growth based strategies are not going to end the crisis by any means. In effect, a policy like this could potentially maintain this two-tier system. And we have to think about the direct effects of displacement in the short term, right? We have to worry about evictions because there's no promise that people won't be evicted when speculators and investors see an opportunity now that the floodgates have opened already, but will be more incentivized to build luxury units. And then we have to think about the long-term effects of neighborhood change, right? The rise of suburban poverty and the rise of poverty in place for people who remain in inner core cities that are quickly gentrifying.
And people are, one of the questions about this is whether this kind of construction and development would really change the character and feel of neighborhoods when you start adding hype. Let's go to our callers again. Hi, Nia. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there. So I just wanted to make a couple quick points. I believe that none of these new units in the new developments that would be built across the state will be rent controlled, because rent control law for the cities that have it, and not every city has it, it only covers buildings built after 1979. So Lewis saying that developers will offer tenants rent controlled units, I don't understand that. I think that's nonsense. And I really believe that this is the wrong way to go about this, by doing it in Sacramento through legislation versus the voters, mainly because removing local controls and opening the door on cookie-cutter development in all cities in California, where, say, like San Francisco is treated like Napa because of the blanket legislation, that makes no sense whatsoever. And, you know, San Francisco is a very densely built city. We do need to build more. I think we should focus on truly affordable housing. But I'm also leery of letting electeds decide these things without voter input, because of all the money from developers and realtors that has flowed into a lot of our politicians. It's a terrible time. So that's, and I also think that SB 827 is really bad legislation, and no amount of amendments is going to improve it. Thank you.
Thank you, Nia. So, Lewis, I'm going to let you weigh in. Would SB 827 reduce the amount of affordable housing, rent-controlled unit, or perhaps even some people are concerned that it would prevent communities from asking developers for community benefits?
Great. You know, like I mentioned, these are all super valid concerns, and we want to make sure that we're working them out. But several, I would say, of the characterizations from the caller were not correct. I'd first start with the idea that San Francisco is a dense city. San Francisco is a dense city by Californian standards, but it's 4.5 times less dense than the city of Paris, which everybody enjoys going to. I've never been to Paris myself, but, you know, Paris is, I think, fairly world-renowned as a beautiful place to hang out. And so San Francisco, I would say, has much to live up to in that regard. The bill does require three main things that do require the net increase of affordable housing. So the first is it has a no net loss provision on affordable housing units, meaning if you demolish an affordable housing unit, you have to replace it at that level of affordability in addition to whatever else you're building. The bill also has a non-optional requirement for what I'm calling this developer-funded rent control. So if developers want to build with SB 827, they have to follow this provision that would say they pay for any rent increases that the tenant is subjected to and then required to provide a new unit at whatever the tenant was paying before the new building came up.
Okay.
After the building's done. So that is absolutely developer-funded rent control.
It may not
be called that, but it is that.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm going to let that be your statement, your closing statement, as we come to the closing minutes of the program. Michelle Majeed, what is your best case?
Yeah, I would say people shouldn't be directly displaced in the first place, right? I think, again, you have to match intent to reality. And the reality is that it's excruciating difficult to find comparable affordable housing in your neighborhood, let alone the cities that you live in. And this bill would exacerbate that problem because it directly displaces communities of color.
Well, Michelle Majeed, thank you so much. Program Director of Equitable Development at Urban Habitat, a nonprofit that seeks to confront structural inequities in housing. Thank you so much for joining us. And Luis Marante, Legislative and Partnerships Director at California YIMBY, a statewide pro-housing development group. We've been talking about SB 827. Sorry we couldn't get to all of your calls, but it's one of those issues that's ever-changing, amendments made as recently as yesterday. So we will keep you up on it and no doubt revisit this issue. You can listen to past shows or listen to our podcast at yourcallradio.org or follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio. Laura Winnes is the producer of today's show. Joshua Wilner is the social media producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I thank you for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call.